Hello, welcome back to TL Talks Podcast. I am TL. It's good to have you guys. So this week's format will be a little bit different because there's a lack of football to talk about. Things haven't really changed as it sits right now, based on what I've heard. According to how they're treating coronavirus, etc., it sounds like they're possibly still on pace for a games to start when they're supposed to start. I think the big difference for the teams will be they'll have less time together and less time, learning. I shouldn't say that. They're still doing it virtually. So in-person stuff, you know what I mean? Like quarterbacks getting timing with receivers, just in-person, whether it be bonding with your team or getting to know your team or just teaching stuff in-person. I think that's what teams are going to have less of this year because of coronavirus, and so we'll see how that pans out. Unfortunately for the Browns, they have a new head coach and stuff like that, and a lot of new staff, and so putting in new systems on offense and defense will be a little bit harder with less time to teach those things. But hopefully, they've done a great job with the virtual part of it, and so players aren't too far behind once they actually get together. Physically. But anyways, the only thing I want to go over with you guys before we get into the actual interview is my thought of the day. So I know I went out of order there, but whatever. So my thought of the day has to do with, I want to say social justice warriors. I'm not even sure if that's the right term. Hopefully I'm not misspeaking. But basically, if you're on social media, you're definitely familiar with what I'm about to talk to you about. Basically, these are people that feel the need to basically police social media. So whether that be, criticizing somebody or doing the back and forth thing on social media where you're arguing about stuff, they just are always, these bleeding hearts that are basically just looking for a cause or a person to kind of be offended by or argue with, in my opinion. And so I recently had an interaction with somebody on social media, and it pretty much reminded me why social media is progressively becoming more and more irritating to me as time goes on. This has nothing to do with what's going on in America right now with the murder of George Floyd and, the fallout from that. That has nothing to do with that at all. What it has to do with is I am becoming more and more agitated with people that think that they're kind of like the self-righteous type, right? So what happened today, let me tell you the story. I was scrolling through Facebook like I usually do, and this guy that I actually served in the military with, he had posted on there basically that he was displeased with Mark Wahlberg because of some stuff that has come to light recently about things that he did when he was much younger. And he ended his post by saying hashtag canceled. So what that person was saying was that now that he's heard that Mark Wahlberg has done these things when he was much younger and obviously less mature, that warrants him basically canceling Mark Wahlberg. So what that means is he's not going to support Mark Wahlberg anymore. He's not going to watch his movies. He's not going to support him in any way, shape, or form. So here's the problem with that, folks. This is what I told him. I said, this is the problem with social media nowadays. On social media, people feel like they have the right to judge somebody, first of all, without knowing the whole story most of the time. So a lot of people will get one part of the story or one person's side of the story, and that's enough, for conviction. So my problem with that is, first of all, if you don't have the whole story, it's obviously foolish for you to judge anybody. But then taking a step further, as far as having this cancel culture where people think that it's okay to cancel somebody because of something, especially something that they did a long time ago, when they were a different person then, I just don't support it. I think it's bullshit. I think it shows a lack of tolerance. I think there's some things that people shouldn't tolerate, right? Especially later in life when they're mature enough and know better than to do certain things and treat people in a decent way. But for you to try to be, judge, jury, and executioner for a person that made a mistake, 20 years ago or when that person was a minor or whatever the, details are, it's just ludicrous to me. It's completely ridiculous. But yeah, this guy felt the need to make this post and then say canceled. And so on one hand, I'm thinking to myself, okay, you saying that Mark Wahlberg is canceled doesn't fucking matter. Common sense tells you Mark Wahlberg doesn't need your support, right? Like, he's doing okay for himself. He's doing pretty well. I don't think he's a bad person. I think he probably did some immature things when he was younger, or maybe could be construed as being somewhat racist when he was younger and less mature. But to say that this guy's a bad guy and he doesn't deserve any support anymore and we should cancel him, you know what I mean? All this like deep demonizing or whatever the word is, I'm just not with it, to be honest with you. I think it's completely ridiculous. People like to get on their self-righteous high horses. And I just think it's all bullshit. And so I obviously do not support that. I replied to the guy's post and said, my 2 cents on it. And then he replied to me with some other stuff that didn't make any sense to me. And, at that point I was like, it's not even worth it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to talk any sense into this guy's head. He thinks he's right. He's not trying to listen to anybody else's opinion. And, to be honest with you guys, I'm not interested in going back and forth with people at all. Like, I'm interested in going back and forth with somebody in a conversation, especially in person or on the phone, where we can talk and take turns talking and listening and learning from each other. But on social media, that's not what it is. On social media, it's just people waiting for their turn to talk and then them not listening and just giving their biased opinion. So not with that shit. It's an understatement. But I wanted to share that with you guys because I'm becoming more and more agitated with it. I think the older that I get, I sometimes wonder how long I'm going to have social media before I'm just kind of fed up with it and just kind of, leave it all together. But for now, it's still functional enough that it serves its purpose. And it's, obviously a great way to stay in touch with friends and, just share stuff that you want to share. And so I'm not there yet, but it is very agitating to see people say stuff like that. It's unfortunate, man. It's just, that whole self-righteous stuff where you think that you, first of all, that it even matters that you're saying you're canceling somebody, like that whole thing just sounds so pretentious and just self-absorbed. It just complete bullshit. There's some people, with that being said, the last thing I'll say before I move on to the interview is there is some people that should be canceled. there's some people that have done things that show their true colors. And those people deserve to suffer the consequences. And some people don't deserve to be supported in their career based on things that they've done. But to paint a broad stroke and basically search for things that people have done in their past, I guess my closing point is just that, like I told the guy, like, I guess you're perfect, man. You know what I mean? Like, I guess you never made any mistakes when you were younger. You know what I mean? Like, I know that I've made mistakes. I know I'm not perfect. I know, 13-year-old Terry is much different than 39-year-old Terry. I've evolved. I've matured. I've learned a lot of lessons the hard way, but I'm nothing like my teenage self. And so it's just the whole thing annoys me. But yeah, I just had to get off my chest. It happened today. And it's I see it all the time, and it's really hard to see people act that way. I mean, it's a lack of empathy. It's a lack of understanding. It's just they think that, yeah, we should just cancel this person based on a mistake he made when he was, you know, a young kid or much younger than he is now. And I just don't think that's fair. And I think the last thing I'll say about it is people that are on Facebook, they're not Mark Wahlberg, right? So they're not famous. They don't have anybody digging into their past. Nobody cares about their past. And so I think it's one of those things where when it's not you, it's easy to be critical and judge and kind of be an asshole. But if the things were switched around and somebody was looking into your past or, you know what I mean? It's one of them things, man. These people just feel so self-righteous that they got to blurt out ridiculous things like so-and-so is canceled. Get the fuck out of here. But anyways, sorry for that rant. I just had to get out off my chest. So without further ado, I'm going to get into the interview this week. My interview is with Mr. Darren Villano. So Darren Villano is a guy that I served in the Navy with. So when I was in the Navy from 09 to 13, we were on a ship called the U.S. Enterprise. The USS. The Enterprise is an aircraft carrier in Norfolk, Virginia that we both served on together. And so that's pretty awesome. He was a friend of mine while we served, and then we stayed in touch for a while after I got out, but then kind of lost touch. He deleted his Facebook about 4 years ago, so we lost touch a little bit. But with the current events that are happening in our country, he kind of came to mind. There was a sheriff deputy that I kind of had on my list of people to interview next because I wanted to hear – basically talk to a cop and hear their two cents on, the protests and just what's going on in our country right now, just to get their kind of perspective. But unfortunately, that the guy that I tried to interview, his boss said he should not do the interview. And so then I thought about Darren, who I served with, and he's kind of like a military cop. And so he's an awesome guy, really awesome to talk to. A guy I get along with really well. And so since I hadn't talked to him in a while, I was thinking he'd be a great option for an interviewee as well. And so I linked up with him. We knocked the interview out. The cool thing is this is the first interview I've ever done where he was not in the United States. So he actually is stationed overseas in Japan. And so that was a little bit different as far as how to record the interview. But we figured it out. And I thought it was a pretty good interview. So hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. So without further ado, here is Darren Villano.
Darren Villano to the Teal Talks podcast. He is currently in Japan with my first guest I've ever had that's literally outside of the continental U.S. So first of all, thanks for joining me.
Hey, I appreciate you having me, and honored to be your first international podcast interview, so that's awesome.
Yeah, man, for sure. So, just to give my guests an idea of how we know each other, most of my guests that listen to, a handful of my interviews know that, or my podcast actually, know that I was in the military. I was in the United States Navy, I think from 2009, 2013. So I did 4 years, and I got out and moved to Colorado. But in those 4 years, I had the honor of serving with you. I call you D, but technically your name is Darren. But, I was able to serve with you, D, on the U.S. Enterprise in Norfolk, Virginia. And so that was really cool. I actually joined the Navy as a storekeeper, and then that rate ended up getting changed to logistics specialist. And then I ended up, as luck would have it, spending about half my time in the 4 years in security with you, doing kind of TAD work, temporarily assigned duty. And we made a joke on our last phone call that I was probably better at that than my original job. Life works out like that sometimes. So that's how we know each other. And let me think if I forgot anything. So, yeah, we served on the Enterprise together, And as I've already said, you're in Japan now, which is awesome. I wasn't even sure if it would be possible to do an interview with you being over there, but we figured it out. There is a way for somebody to call me and then do the interview that way. And so I'm glad that worked out. So that's how we know each other. The first question for you, Dee, is kind of your background. So me and you know each other pretty well. I think on like a friend level, like, you know, we get along well, we can talk easily. Whenever I talk to you, you know, it seems like no time has passed, even though it's been years. But as is most, you know, relationships with people in life, there's a lot of people in our lives that we don't really know a lot about their past, you know what I mean, or their background, or, you know, where they were raised or stuff like their upbringing, et cetera. And so if you don't mind, kind of give us that spiel about, you know, your background.
Absolutely. So I'm born and raised in the great state of New Jersey, also known as Jersey for us Jerseyans. started, you know, graduated high school, you know, at the age of 18. That was back in 1993. Mm-hmm. And got into construction. I was what I went to school for, selected a trade. I was one of these kids that, you know, graduated high school, and I was like, I don't know what I want to do. My family was in the business of construction, so I was like, hey, you know what, let me follow in that suit and, you know, do construction. So got into, you know, construction, was in a part of the union for a little while, started off as a laborman, and then, you know, graduated and certified as a journeyman, did kitchen remodeling, did fire restoration. So that's where I started my life. And, you know, I liked it a lot. I was a young 19, 20-year-old, 21-year-old in the business making, you know, pretty good money, $400, $500, $600 cash, you know, every week. So you throw that kind of money at a kid, they're going to stick with it. But 2006 kind of came along. I'm sorry. 1996. The housing market kind of, you know, I wouldn't say dried up, but people were not spending money on remodeling and, you know, putting investments into their homes. So, you know, I started to get laid off of work. I called my boss, like, hey, boss, we got any work today? He's like, nope, stay home. So I needed to start thinking about a different career field.
Yeah.
So I got into emergency medical technician, the EMT. I got certified as an EMT. Did a lot of volunteer work at a emergency medical technician volunteer squad in Maplewood, New Jersey, and really learned kind of getting into what would now be my passion, which would be, you know, first responding and helping people. You know, that was like a huge drive for me, was the ability to go out on a call, you know, 911 call and help people medically that needed, you know, medical emergency. And I've seen it all, man, from delivering a baby, you know, in a snowstorm, in a blizzard in 1997, to a, you know, decapitations. I mean, I've seen a lot of crazy stuff in that field. But having the ability to help people was amazing. Fast forward a little bit into 1999, and that's when I actually joined the Navy. Small note that you probably don't know about is I actually wanted to become a Marine.
Interesting.
I went to the Marine Corps recruiter and they were closed. So the Navy recruiter was open and I wanted to just get into the service at that point. So Marine Corps, sorry, you lost out. Navy, you lucked in because you guys just happened to be open. And, signed up as an enlisted guy. They were closed, man. I mean, who does that? Who closes a recruiting office? I don't know if they were out to lunch. I don't know if they were PTing. I don't know what they were doing, but
they lost that on D because of that.
They lost a good recruit, man.
Yeah, they missed the boat. No pun intended.
So yeah, joined the Navy in '99, and it's been a ride ever since. I'll be 21 years coming this September.
Yeah, it's crazy, huh? Interesting. Yeah. The Marine thing is interesting to me. not this is about me, but when I joined the military, I joined later in life, as you know. I was like, you know, 28 years old, and it's funny because I never really envisioned myself being in the military. But like you said, you know, life just kind of deals you a mixed bag of things, and sometimes you're kind of at a crossroads where, you know, you never know what the next step will be for you, like what's going to be best for you based on where you're at in life. And so for me, the military was definitely my best option, and I definitely don't regret it. It's funny, I tell people one of my two best decisions in life, one of them is joining the military, and another one is leaving the military. Like, they were both the right decisions at the time. And so I definitely don't regret it. I made, you know, friends like you that I'll have for a lifetime, hopefully. And I got to see the world. You know, I got to pay off some debt and pay off my car and stuff like that. So way more positives than negatives. And so you're definitely very fortunate for those things. But, yeah, I mean, with your background, before I start asking you about other stuff, so obviously I knew you were from Jersey. I didn't know that your family was involved in construction, and that's kind of what you started out doing. I'm not surprised to hear that one of your passions is helping people. I think that's why me and you have always gotten along really well, because you're not like, you just like people cross paths with you in life, and you just feel like they get you on a certain level. And it's not really, I don't know, it's like kind of hard to put into words, but you just like, they might call it kindred spirits, but it's like you just connect with them on a certain level. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Where you just kind of vibe with them. That's all how I always felt about my relationship with me and you. And so that's one of my passions too. So that part doesn't surprise me. When I was younger and I was trying to figure out what I was going to have as a college, you know, major and stuff like that, I was like, well, I want to help people. So what professions can help people? And I thought about, you know, different ones like doctors and policemen and psychiatrists and stuff like that. And the only one that I could see myself doing was being a therapist. And so I kind of pursued that. I went to school for psychology, then eventually switched over to social work. And then recently, not like 2 years ago, I found out that what I'm making at my job right now at Kaiser Permanente here in Colorado is more than what I would make with a master's in social work. And so I was like, well, do I want to go through my senior year and my master's year, which are going to be the most grueling years to go through with all those internship hours, to get paid less? Probably not. And so I kind of put school on pause, but I have a good life, man. So, you know, think everything happens for a reason, and I'm definitely very blessed. One question this is kind of random, but one question I wanted to ask you, based on your background, is PTSD. So you mentioned, you know, you were EMT, you saw some crazy stuff, right? And then you've also been in the military for 20 plus years, and I'm sure you've seen, I know you've seen some stuff, I'm not sure how much stuff, because I'm not a stalker, but I know you've seen some stuff based on just me and you serving together. But based on that, Dee, how would you say you gauge PTSD for yourself? Like, you seem like a pretty normal guy. Like, you don't seem, you know, like you're messed up in the head and you're like, you know, reeling from what you've seen in your life. But you also seem like a very mentally strong, you know, tough guy. And so, you know, I'm not sure. You know what I mean? Maybe you can answer that question better than I can. But where do you think you'd fall in that range of being affected by seeing crazy stuff?
Well, if you remember, prior to me coming to the Enterprise in 2009, I had just returned from a combat tour of 12 months in Afghanistan. So I did my 1 year combat tour in Afghanistan, which was probably one of the most rewarding tours of duty I have ever taken. Yeah. Having the ability to do that was pretty awesome. With that said, the things that you see, the things that you do, the things that you hear, right, the things that you're a part of affect you moving forward. And that that definitely had a negative impact on my life, both personally and relationship-wise, which took a long time to rebound from. So the PTSD is 100% real. It is 100% authentic, and if gone unchecked, can really hurt people. And, you know, military members are not the only ones that are susceptible to PTSD. I mean, normal everyday citizens walking around the earth, humans, are susceptible to PTSD. And I think there's a misnomer of PTSD because it ties and relates a lot more to the military. However, seeing what we're seeing on our TV screens and, you know, in our cities, what, you know, now that could cause folks to have post-traumatic stress in their lives moving forward.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. So I definitely agree with everything you just said. And you said that the Afghanistan tour you did before me and you served together was one of the most rewarding things you've ever done, but it also had a great effect on you negatively for a while, professionally and personally. So I feel like you kind of in a roundabout way answered that question. So where would you put yourself on that spectrum? Like, would you say the Afghanistan thing was the only thing you really dealt with where you felt like you felt the weight of PTSD? Or do you think, you know what I mean, how would you gauge that from your own point of view?
Well, I mean, you were there on the Enterprise, and you saw firsthand, especially being a part of security, some of the turmoil that we dealt with on one of those deployments, you know, two suicides. We had the Somali pirate issue, which that was a pretty significant thing. I mean, you were part of it. So that's that right there is, you know, I think that has lingering effects as well. So I think to answer your question, you know, absolutely yes, negatively impacts. But you have to, and this is kind of what worked for me, is having outlets. One of my major outlets was physical fitness. Getting really tied into pushing out that aggression and pushing out some of that those issues that I was dealing with helped significantly.
Mm. Gotcha. All right, fair enough. So, yeah, the first question I had written down to ask you about was kind of your Navy journey. So, obviously, I knew about your Afghanistan tour before I met you, and, you know, I had a good pulse on you the 4 years we served together. And then when I recently reconnected with you, you told me that you had become a commissioned officer, which is awesome. And so, I mean, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of details in between, but if you don't mind, give us kind of a virtual tour of your Navy journey since it's been, you know, 20 years plus.
Yeah, I'll give you and the listeners the 5-minute version because, you know, when it goes about my career, I can talk for an hour.
okay, that's fair.
So, you know, started off as an undesignated airman. You know, actually, I was an E-1, undesignated E-1 when I first started my career. Worked my butt off, got selected into a rate, which is the aviation rate, which is AE. Made the rank of E-5, submitted my package to cross-rate into the Master of Arms rating, because back then that's how you had to do it. Successful at that, 2003, became a Master of Arms. Became an MA at a Master of Arms at MA as an MA2, E5. And then it was pretty much uphill from there. Made first class pretty fast, but then I kind of had a little bit of a stretch. I was a first class for about 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And then I got selected for chief. Because was a chief. After my tour on the Enterprise, I got selected to be a chief. And then shortly thereafter, I got selected to be a limited duty officer, to where I can stay within the community of the Master of Arms rate, but lead them and be a security officer.
Gotcha. Okay. So, yeah, I didn't know that you started off undesignated and then worked in aviation and then you selected to pursue MA. So that's pretty cool to know that background. And then, like you said, you came in MA2, made MA1 pretty quickly, stayed there for a while, and then made chief, and then from there you became an LDO. So I guess one of my only specific questions about your journey is that whole transition from Chief to LDO. Like, how did that come about? Like, what are the steps to that happening? Do you feel like your life's changed since you've become an LDO? Like, obviously I've never been an officer before, so I have no idea how that would be.
Well, I can tell you the quality of life coming from the enlisted ranks to the officer ranks is a change the day that you commission, financially and also, logistically. You know, everything that you get, I don't want to say better. It's just on another level. But with that said, you have way more responsibility. You know, you're held to a way higher standard than, you know, I would ever have been in the enlisted ranks, you know, where if you screw up as an enlisted member, you know, as you well know, you know, when you've seen several of our shipmates get in trouble, you know, I don't want to say you get slapped on the wrist, but you get disciplined and then you kind of move forward and you can recoup from that. Yeah. The officer ranks, you make a mistake, 9 times out of 10, that's a wrap. You're going home. So you're held to a higher standard, which, you know, encompasses the whole, you know, responsibility thing. You know, we're paying you more money. We're giving you more things. We're going to hold you more accountable. And rightfully so. You know, you're the leadership of the, you know, whatever service that you're in. So you need to be held accountable for what you say, for what you do, for everything. I mean, it's not just when you're in a uniform. It's, you know, in and out. You know, it's conducting yourself outside. You know, it's everywhere. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that's always been ingrained in my brain. You know, when I leave the house or when I go do something, I make sure I look myself in the mirror and say, hey, you know what, this is going to be, you know, an upstanding day, and I'm going to make sure that I don't discredit. And that's just necessarily myself. But, you know, everybody that I, you know, that supports me and also who I represent.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's mostly common sense within the military that officers make more than enlisted. But like you said, with that upgrade in lifestyle and upgrade in pay, comes responsibility. You know what I mean? So it's not, there's going to be something attached to that. So you have to earn that money. Yeah, man, that's interesting. How long ago did you switch over to officer?
6 years ago, man.
Okay. So you're so how does that work with LDO? I know, like, I remember the ranks of officers. You know what I mean? Like ensign. You know, the third one is lieutenant, etc. And I know there's like warrant officers, but where does LDO fall on that? How does that?
So LDOs are considered technical. Managers, to where we're LDOs are put in the responsibility of leading people. The warrant officer community are more your technical trainers. They're more your subject matter experts of that particular field. Not to say that an LDO is not an SME and not a subject matter expert, but the warrant officers are really in tune with, you know, being that SME for whatever that specific field that they're representing or that they're in. So there's a little bit of difference between, you know, the warrants and the LDOs, but at the end of the day, we're, you know, the CWO and the LDO community, we're one, obviously considered Mustangs. So we're basically tied at the hip.
Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough. So next question is about Japan. So ironically, if I had stayed in the Navy, you know, obviously, you know, there's a rotation of sea duty, shore duty, et cetera. My plan, if I were to stay in for shore duty, was to try, and I don't know if I would have been successful, but to try to be stationed in either Italy or Japan. Italy, because for obvious reasons, me and you are both Italian. I had the privilege of visiting Italy when I was on the Enterprise, and I got to stay in Rome for a night. So that was really awesome. I tell people, you know, when I tell people my Navy stories, I'm like, it's funny because when I went to Italy, I got off the boat, you know, for Liberty, and I was looking around, and, you know, I see Italian people all around me, and it was weird because I felt like I was at home, but I had never been there before. And so,
right.
To some extent, you know, I just look around, everybody looks like me, they all talk with their hands like I do, like, you know, it's like home away from home.
it's just a really cool place, and I would have loved to spend more time there. So that was kind of my loose plan for sure to do if I had stayed in. But my point is that, you know, Italy was for obvious reasons, and then Japan was another option that I wanted to pursue because obviously I'd never been there before, but also I've heard mostly good things about Japan. You know what I mean? I've heard that people think it's beautiful. I've heard that people enjoy their time there. And so I wanted to ask you about Japan yourself. Like, what is your opinion of living there? What are the pros and cons? I know with COVID, you guys are probably kind of itching to get back to the U.S., but that's kind of a rare pandemic thing. But, yeah, what is your opinion of Japan, based on your experiences?
So I love Japan. We've been in Japan since 2017.
Yeah.
I was down in the Sasebo area, which is southern island of Japan, and now I'm up north near Tokyo. And it's great, man. Japan is probably one of the best places I've ever lived, obviously outside the United States.
Yeah.
The people are so, friendly. The culture here is just, it's a very patient culture. And coming from a hustle and bustle United States, when you come in, and you live in a country that has so many patients all around, everywhere you go, I mean, people don't mind standing in line here at all. I mean, that's not a problem. They don't complain. They just do it, and just to see and be a part of that culture for going on 3 years now, it's been awesome. And I'm fortunate and I'm thankful that we're here. I'm thankful that my wife is here and my kids are here, so they can experience Japan. It's been awesome.
Hmm. So what would you say are the most obvious differences between the U.S. and Japan from your perspective?
Besides so obviously the number one thing would be language. Although Japanese do learn English in their schools, they don't speak English to other to Americans.
Right.
The desire is for foreigners, both serving in the military and those working here for other companies, it's for you to learn Japanese. So to blend in with that culture and to be able to communicate better, you got to learn the language. So I'd say that's probably one of the most challenges of being in Japan is being able to communicate. They can understand you, and if you speak English to them, some of them will speak English back. Mm-hmm. But the mindset is that for you to learn their language and communicate with the locals in Japanese.
Gotcha. How much Japanese do you know?
I can say good morning. I can say good afternoon. I can say good evening.
The basics.
I can say goodbye. I can, I can go to a restaurant and we can order food. But I would like to learn more Japanese. And that was one of my goals when we got here was to be I wanted to be 100% fluent and speak Japanese.
Yeah.
I've kind of, that's left my radar a little bit. I need to kind of get that back. And I still would like to leave here having to be able to have a conversation in Japanese.
Gotcha. Okay. So last thing I want to ask you about before we get into current events, which is going to be the meat and potatoes of the interview, is triathlons. When I talked to you to set up this interview, you mentioned how you kind of were getting into some pretty extreme physical fitness events, and you actually had one scheduled, I think, this year, and it got postponed for obvious reasons. Tell us about that. I don't know much about them myself. Obviously, I know what they are, but I don't know anything, beyond that. I don't know how people train for it. I don't know what a good time is. I don't know if there's different types. Like, I'm pretty ignorant to a lot of it. And so educate us as good as you can, and tell us a little bit about your journey with that sport, if you don't mind.
Sure. So triathlon is swim, bike, and run. Three disciplines within endurance sports. Obviously combined together in one simple race to see who can achieve all within the amount of time frame that you have for it. There's several different levels of triathlon. You have a sprint level triathlon. You have an Olympic distance triathlon. You have a half distance Ironman, which is a 70.3, and then you have a full Ironman, which is the, you know, the ultimate goal, which is, you know, you're talking 9 hours of, you know, straight up nonstop physical fitness PT endurance, you know, whether you're swim, bike, or run. How I got into it was in November of last year. We were watching Netflix, my wife and I, and I came across that show, Game Changers. And I was watching that, and I was kind of talking about, you know, plant-based dieting and kind of, you know, going away from meats and seeing what the effects of plant-based was. Well, I decided that I was going to try the plant-based world for a little while and kind of go away from meat. Fast forward 7 months, and I'm still a plant-based guy. I have not had meat in almost 8 months. So that kind of started my journey with getting into endurance training. Because of going plant-based, I lost all of my aches and my pains from weightlifting that I was so involved in. And I felt my body was able to go more and do something different and be more, push it more to a limit. And I knew I was not going to get that satisfaction out of going to the gym and working out and lifting weights, you know, picking stuff up and putting stuff down, which I still enjoy. I needed something different. I wanted to challenge myself and have a new goal. And, Ironman was the dream, and I saw that, and I was like, you know what? I told my wife, I was like, I can do that. I said, I can train for that, and I can complete an Ironman. So I set out on this journey in the end of November, beginning of December, and as you said, my first race was supposed to be in June here in Japan, but obviously due to COVID-19, that got postponed, and now my race is scheduled for October here in Japan. So I just started a new 19-week training cycle. Started Tuesday. And I'm ready to rock and roll. I feel great. I'm swimming. I'm cycling and I'm running. It's amazing. I'm going to be 46 years old in December. And having just come off of, you know, so many years of just weightlifting and being in this sport for only 7 months, I feel that I have progressed my fitness and my health, you know, tenfold, and I'm in the best shape of my life.
Interesting, man. So what is the training like, regimen like, how does that look? You know what I mean? Obviously you're practicing, I assume, you're practicing swimming, you know, running and biking. But how does that look like literally, you know, on a daily basis? Like, is it intervals or how structured is it as a look?
So on any training cycles, so I'll just give you a snapshot of a week. So
sure.
I'll give you a snapshot of this week. So Monday was a rest day for me. Tuesday was a swim and a cycle. Mm-hmm. And then Wednesday was a run. Today is a cycle. Tomorrow is a swim and a run. Friday is a cycle. And then Saturday is a swim and another run. And then Sunday is a full-on swim. So a lot of it changes based on how close or how far away you are from your race. Intensities will increase.
Yeah.
Intensities will decrease. You don't really focus on distance. And that's kind of one of the things that I've enjoyed at this journey with triathlon and endurance training is, you know, I'm not just going out and saying, I'm going to run 10 miles today. You know, I'm going out and I'm running for an hour. And within that hour, you know, depending on what the structured program is, whether I'm training in zone one, zone two, zone three, or zone four, as it relates to heart rate, I am hitting different distances. So like the day before yesterday, my schedule was to run for an hour. I biked in the morning. I did 16.78 miles in the morning. I only had an hour on the bike, so that's what I got in for an hour. And then later in the afternoon, I went out for a run for an hour, and I wound up hitting 6.2 miles based on just what the actual structure of the workout was. So that could increase or decrease depending on what the plan of the day is for that specific training event, for that specific discipline. So it all varies, which is good because you're not just beating yourself down, you know, day after day after day, which will result in injury. So, like I said, it's been, when I first started, I couldn't swim 25 meters. I would get in the pool, I would swim 25 meters, and I would be gassed. Now I'm swimming 15, 1,500, 1,750, 2,000 meters without stopping. So it just goes to show you, you know, when you put your body into a regimental training program, you have results. And it doesn't really matter what age you are. You know, I've never been a believer of, well, I'm too old for this, so I can't do this no more. I should have done it when I was younger. As long as you're breathing, I believe that anything is possible when it comes to physical fitness journey.
Interesting. So you said when you biked for an hour, how far did you go? 16 miles?
So the last one was 16.78 miles, yeah. And okay. I was to maintain a zone one, zone two heart rate, which is no more than 142 beats per minute.
Interesting. If you don't mind, D, can you repeat those different types of triathlons? Because I'm going to write those down and do some research myself. So you said sprint and what were the other ones?
So you got a sprint distance, you have an Olympic distance, you have a half, which is a 70.3, and then you have a full-on Ironman.
Okay. And full Ironman is obviously the ultimate, right? That's the goal?
Yes. So it's 140 miles between swim, bike, and run.
Yeah, it sounds kind of crazy.
Just think about working out for 9 hours on a Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking, your rest time is during your transitions from the swim to the bike to the run, but they're not really rest. You're just taking off your crap, you know, transitioning from the bike, getting off the bike, taking your helmet off, getting out of your cycling shoes, putting on your running shoes, and you're going. So it's really not a rest, if they call it a transition. But it's exciting because it's hard. And that's what drove me to wanting to do it, because not everybody has the heart to do it.
Oh, for sure. So you mentioned kind of asking yourself the question, can you do these things within the time limit that they give you? So is there a time limit for a full Ironman, like a cutoff, or how does that work?
So I think I have not run an Ironman myself, so I believe you have to finish within 17 hours. If you go over 17 hours, they'll pull you from the course. So if you're on your run, and you have, you know, 4 hours left and you're at that 17-hour mark, they're going to DQ you and they're going to pull you from the course.
Gotcha. 17 hours. Got it. Just write these notes for myself. Maybe if you move on.
And the same thing for this.
Join me.
And the same thing for the sprint and the Olympic and the half. They all have hour cutoffs as well.
Gotcha. Just different ones, I assume?
Yeah, so a sprint, you can probably knock a sprint out in an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Olympic, you can knock that out in about 3 hours. A half Ironman, you can complete that with about 6 to 7 hours. And then, obviously, the kit caboodle for the full Ironman. I mean, there's people that are, you know, 840 Ironman, you know, Ironman competitors and faster than that. I believe your average is probably 10, 12, 13, 14, 15.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was to finish and not DQ, I would be a happy guy.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you that. What would be your guess of what you would have ran if COVID hadn't cock-blocked you?
So I believe, and this is me putting a lot of pressure on myself, is I, for my age group, I still have this belief for October, for my age group, I believe I will I will have a podium finish for my age group.
So you don't have an idea of what the around what time you get? Because it's just too hard to gauge.
So I will shoot for a 3 hour. That would be my goal, a 3 or 4 hour.
So which type of triathlon are you doing in October?
So it's a Olympic distance triathlon.
Okay, Olympic. Okay, gotcha. Gotcha. So that would be what you're aiming for. Okay, cool. I got all those notes written down, so I'll definitely look up some more research myself, because that would be cool, man. Like you said, it's really hard. A lot of people can't do it or aren't willing to do it. And as we get older, it's important to find those things to kind of challenge yourself. And so, I think one of my struggles is, as a former athlete, when I don't have much of a goal, if I'm not working towards something besides just overall fitness, it's kind of hard for me to be motivated, because I'm a competitive guy by nature. And so I think that kind of, satiates that that desire. So maybe I could join you in that journey, especially if you guys move out to Colorado. That would be pretty cool to link up. So who knows?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Who knows? So, yeah, last question before we get into current events. It's funny how these questions lead into other questions, but I'm a thorough person, so what can I say? So my last question for you, D, is Navy SEALs. So when you were talking to me about triathlons and how you don't really buy into, I'm too old to do this, and how you've always been a guy that likes to challenge yourself physically and stay fit, but now – you have specific goals with these races coming up. So what is your opinion of Navy SEALs? And this isn't like a, political statement about Navy SEALs within the Navy. Well, the reason I'm asking you is because obviously most people consider Navy SEALs to be the top of the top from a physical perspective. They go through Hell Week. It's very hard to get in. Not many people do get in. They have a high dropout rate. But I have heard people say that Navy SEAL, some people's opinion, Navy SEALs is basically a group of guys that just literally won't quit. Like they say, basically that's all it is just not quitting. And so what is your take on that? I know that I don't think you've done that stuff, but you have been in the Navy for over 20 years, so I'm sure you have two cents about that perspective.
So, I mean, in my personal opinion, I believe, the SEAL community, they're savages. They're not savages as far as how they act. Their mentality is of the savage mentality to where there's no specific, hey, well, this guy's got the perfect body type, so he should be a SEAL. It is that mental fortitude. I've never been through Hell Week. I've never been down the buds. I thought about it when I was younger in my career. But again, I at that point in time in my life, I didn't think that I was had the ability to complete that training. So I did not go that route. The mental fortitude and, having been stationed in San Diego and been close to the buds compound and seeing and hearing Hell Weeks go on from the roads. I can tell you that it is a mind game, and if you can get past that and succeed in that mind game of physical challenges and mind, I think that many people would be able to complete that journey. Obviously the most renowned. I mean, there's several. A lot of renowned SEALs. If you read that book, Can't Hurt Me, by David Goggins, who's an absolute savage himself, he kind of gets into the whole holistic mind over matter effect in his book. So I believe that truly, and that's my opinion on the SEALs and their program and their training.
Gotcha. Yeah, so pretty much you're saying both those things are true. On one hand, they are complete savages as far as how tough they are physically and mentally, but also there is some truth to, you know, the mental fortitude of just not letting yourself quit. So I guess both those things are true. Gotcha. All right, perfect, man. So yeah, let's get into current events. This is kind of a heavy subject, but I know you're game for it. As you know, I don't think, just because you're stationed in Japan currently, that current events in the U.S. are that hard for you to grasp, you know, through social media and just the news and stuff like that. So I'm assuming you're pretty tuned in. But since you are, you know, you're a master at arms by trade in the military, that's pretty much the closest thing to law enforcement within the military. I thought you'd be a great candidate to talk about, you know, things from not only your eyes as Darren Villano, but also your eyes as somebody who works in law enforcement, because, you know, the current climate in America is very interesting. It definitely feels like there's a shift going on, which is awesome. I think that's long overdue. But as is anything in life, there's multiple layers of these things, and they're very complicated. And so I guess we can just start with your overall thoughts of, you know, what's going on in America currently as it relates to, you know, the murder of George Floyd, racism and oppression in America, and kind of the switch that we're seeing happening. How does that look through your eyes as it sits right now?
Well, first off, I mean, it's sad to, you know, turn on any, you know, news channel in the world and see a video that we all saw of basically, you know, somebody's life being taken in front of everybody's eyes.
Yeah.
From a police officer's perspective,
yeah,
you know, that was disgusting. And to, you know, to see somebody use their position, and this doesn't even, you know, just fold into the law enforcement community. This is, you know, us as human beings in general.
Yeah.
To think that whatever your position is in life, and whether it be corporate world, whether it be law enforcement, it doesn't matter, you know, to think that you have the right to take somebody's life like that, it truly is disgusting. And I believe that we as humans have lost the compassion and the desire for our fellow man. I really do. And I think in order for us to rebound, I don't think that, you know, criminal justice reforms are great, but until you get rid of the hatred heart of people, you know, in these positions, mm-hmm. until we rid, you know, the hatred that people have in their hearts, we will always have these problems that we're having right now, not just in the United States, but globally. You know, back in, you know, the early days, there was more compassion as far as, you know, people for, you know, the well-being. Now, racism has been, you know, systemic for, you know, since the United States has been, you know, established.
Basically,
you know,
yeah.
If you look at the history books, you can look into our history books. I mean, it's part of history for a reason, because unfortunately that is how the country was founded upon. Mm. But moving forward, you know, we should have grew from that and grew away from that. Do I think that there's equality in the United States? I'd say probably there is some, and then there's some areas where there's not.
Yeah.
And again, that goes back to individuals, how they feel and where their heart's at. Mm. You know, having been a Christian and somebody that was connected with God, and I heard you in one of your other podcasts that you were a follower, and you've kind of distanced yourself away from it for, you know, some reasons, mm-hmm. and I have as well. But I believe this is something that we probably need to get back to, and all of us. I mean, and I'm talking everybody on the global perspective, is that we need to pump the brakes we need to look at what's important and really look internally and see where hatred is in our hearts and eliminate it from, you know, the evil from coming above and trapping people. And, you know, you saw it in the George Floyd video. I mean, the smug look on that guy's face. I mean, it was literally, it made me sick. It almost made me vomit when I saw it, because, you know, his look on his face as this man is, you know, he's handcuffed, he's proned out, he already can't breathe. You know, he's already in a position of asphyxiation.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, you have, you know, not just that one officer, but you have other officers that are, you know, compressing on him. It's just, it was bad. It was really bad. And to me, that's not being a cop. That's having hatred. You 100% have some hatred in your heart, and you feel that you are above, you know, your fellow man. And that goes for all races, white, Black, Hispanic, Asian, you name it. It goes across the board. And until we fix that problem, I don't think we'll see change, not just in the United States, but I don't think we'll see change globally.
Mm. So I guess the first obvious question for you would be, how would you recommend pursuing change, since it is a systemic problem and it is, you know, kind of throughout all the different races, and it's, you know, something that's kind of hard to squash. So what would be your two cents on how to repair that or change that, you know what I mean? Because it's such a complex problem.
Getting back to community. You know, when I was growing up, we had community, you know, policing. We had community neighborhooding. You know, when I was out running around like a knucklehead, when my mom or my dad wasn't home, I had the neighbors, you know, looking at it, and you're close to the same age, so I'm sure you had the same thing. You know, there was neighbors that were around that were there to keep you in line. You know, it was that neighborhood watch, you know, that whole it takes a village mentality. We're too separate right now. You know, we're 100% separate. And if we kind of came back to community, broke down the barriers, you know, the white neighborhoods, the Hispanic neighborhoods, the Black neighborhoods, and, you know, work together and just, again, got rid of that hatred in the heart, and we're able to come together and just kind of, you know, separate the divides, I think that we would definitely, that's where you're going to have your change, is when you, you know, break down, and I'll say those doors, because realistically, when you would drive from neighborhood to neighborhood, you're almost going through different doors. You know, you'll leave the door of your neighborhood, and you're going to another door of another neighborhood, and then you're going to another door of another neighborhood, and all three of those doors lead to different neighborhoods, which are all different. Now, they're different because of, you know, economics and everything else. However, to me, I think that's where you're gonna get your change, is and having some positiveness moving forward is kind of, you know, breaking down those doors and keeping everything even keel, and just, you know, community, being a community. You know, community policing was one of the biggest things that I saw as a kid, and, you know, being a criminal justice major, you learn about community policing. And I don't think we see that anymore. I think that's a thing of the past. I think that's another thing that needs to come back, is bringing, you know, officers out of police cars and into the community on foot, interacting and talking to people and just treating people as humans, man.
Yeah. I don't think it's that hard, but it seems like it is hard for some people.
And it is. And I think a lot of it, again, has to go to that hatred that they have in their heart. That's the number one thing, is we have to, that needs to go away.
Yeah.
The other stuff, I think, can follow.
Yeah. So, first question, I just listened to a little small thing from Joe Rogan's podcast. He just had this guy on, and they were talking about police reform. And they both kind of said their two cents about their take on it and what they think could work and what won't work and stuff like that. But my next question for you would be, let me just throw some opinions at you. So I have a buddy, I went to college with him, and he has a very, very, very strong opinion about police. and it's very, very negative, right? And I, when me and him talked about it, I said that I have a great deal of respect for police. They have a very hard job that I wouldn't want to do. And it's my opinion that cops like this guy in Minneapolis are definitely the minority. And I think that, you know, overall, most cops are good people, and they definitely don't have hate in their heart, and definitely, you know, aren't seeking out to hurt anybody or definitely not kill anybody. But that's just my opinion. But his opinion was much different, right? His opinion was that cops are mostly people that aren't very smart. He said cops are mostly guys that, you know, weren't very popular in high school. So they have kind of a little bit of a power complex, like they want to be in power and, you know, whatever that dynamic is. So his opinion was way different from mine. But with that being said, as we look at, like, police reform, Joe Rogan was talking about how, you know, he thinks it should be harder to become a cop, basically. He didn't give specifics about how you could do that, because obviously it's not easy. So I'm not sure if it's a psych eval or, you know, I think across the board he just thinks that the standards should be higher to become a cop. So what is your two cents on that part? Do you agree with that? Do you think that it's a little bit too easy for anybody to become a cop, or do you think the training should be different, or how does that look through your eyes?
So I think the training, I don't want to say be different, because you can give all of the quality and sensitivity training, you can give that to your boo in the face. If,
right.
Again, if you have somebody that's just not willing to accept it and buy into it, you wasted your time with that training.
Yeah.
In regards to a reform for criminal justice, to make it harder to be a police officer, I agree with that to a certain extent.
Okay.
But you got to remember that being a police officer, you know, these guys are making, you know, your average police officer in the United States is, you know, they're $35,000, $45,000, $55,000 a year starting out. So they're not breaking the bank being a cop.
Right.
Now, to kind of rewind and going back to what your friend was saying regarding why people become police officers.
Right.
Well, I believe that there are people that become cops because they were picked on, bullied, and had issues in their, you know, in their childhood growing up. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
I believe that exists, you know, a lot in, you know, police departments.
Yeah.
There are great police officers that want to serve their community and do things by the book, you know, kind of like how I live my life.
I 100% believe
that there's more people that are doing that job, wearing that badge, and putting their lives on the line with that mentality than what we saw unfold a couple weeks ago. Mm. I was thinking about this a couple of days leading up to this podcast with you. Is, you know, one of the things I think that you can help eliminate, or maybe, you know, utilize as a tool for rooting out, you know, mindful hate in behavior is, you know, police officers take a polygraph. Just like, you know, folks in the military who have clearances, you take a polygraph.
Yeah.
Institute polygraphs for, you know, police officers, not on a regular basis, but on a, you know, some kind of scheduled basis, to where you ask those hard questions and evaluate as they progress in their careers. You know, as you're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years on the force,
mm-hmm.
you know, who knows? Maybe you are suffering from some PTSD that you saw, and that has changed the way of your mentality, what you think.
Yeah.
You might have been asked a question, you know, are you racist? Are you biased against a certain gender or race when you first got hired on as a police officer? But you won't see another polygraph again. You're done once you're hired on. So why not incorporate some kind of a litmus test, if you will, from a polygraph scale, and polygraph officers, you know, every 5 years, every 4 years, every 10 years, to where now you know you can kind of track, you know, how they're responding to these questions. And if they do come up negative, not necessarily fire them, but give them, provide them some help and some guidance and some, you know, mentorship to where maybe they can rid that hatred, or maybe help them deal with some of the issues that they're dealing with, to change their perspective of why they're doing the job that they're doing. To me, I think that would be effective, and utilize some of the funding that, you know, police departments get for being established. Utilize that, you know, from a funding perspective, to pay for, you know, frequent polygraphs for police officers to make sure that their mind is still accurate. I think that is probably a critical key, to make sure that their mind is still accurate, you're still wanting to serve the public, no matter what race, no matter what gender, no matter what neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I think that will be a good test at keeping people accountable.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a really good point, man. Joe Rogan mentioned that too. He said that, you know, not only is it important to know where a police officer's mentality is, like when they join, when they become a cop, but also, like you said, as they've been in for years, right? Like they've been in for 5 or 10 years, over time, naturally people are going to experience things and they're going to change them, sometimes in a major way, sometimes in a minor way. But over the years, people change. And so, in theory, you could have a cop that maybe joined as a cop not having, hypothetically, let's say, not having a racist bone in his body. But then you look at him 15 years in or 10 years in, and now it's a much different story. Because of, who knows, you know, there's different things that happen. And so, you know, periodically having those check-ins, like you said, with polygraphs, could be a great way to kind of gauge that. But I'm not sure if, I can't really think of any way people could manipulate that. I guess it would just be a matter of funding it, but.
So knowing how polygraphs work, you know, when you ask a question, it triggers a response within your body. You know, now there is a small percentage of personnel that live on this earth that have the ability to manage and manipulate that feeling. However, a majority of us can't. So, you know, ask those hard questions. You know, do you have biased, you know, thoughts, or are you, you know, come right out and say it. Are you racist against African Americans? Are you racist against Asians? Are you racist against, you know, whites? You know, ask those hard questions again to just provide a gauge, you know, kind of like what we do in the military. You know, we have when a new CO comes on board and they're on board for 90 days, they do a climate survey. And that climate survey is the opportunity to identify problems within that command. You don't have that in local law enforcement. So, you know, for specific officers, you might have that from a CO or a chief of police perspective, but you don't have that from the individual officers, from the corporal all the way, you know, to sergeant or all the throughout the ranks. And again, their lifetime environments and things that they have seen and their experiences may have changed their thoughts, and maybe they're not suitable to be a police officer anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe you were a good cop for 10 years, but something happened within those 10 years that has changed your mindset and your view of being an effective and a good cop. And maybe it is time for you to transition and not be a police officer anymore. And I think that a polygraph could help doing that.
Mm. I like it. I like it. That's good. That's good problem solving there, D.
You know, and that's the biggest thing, man, is, you know, taking a deep breath and looking, you know, everybody's, and we saw this over these past 2 weeks or, you know, 3 weeks, this horrific event happened, and everybody, you know, wanted action and wanted a solution faster than what it can ultimately come, you know, and Take the looting and all that stuff out of it. You know, just focus on, you know, the you know, the cause for defunding police and the cause for, you know, the Democrat and Republicans going at it, doing what they do. You know, everybody wants action yesterday for something to happen.
Yeah.
And I get it. We all want that. I think that's human nature. But you need to take a deep breath, analyze it, and really decide, okay, how can we fix this problem? You know, and get a think tank going on. You know, and get, you know, have a census go out and don't just ask, you know, a certain amount of people, you know, go broadband and find out, you know, what majority of the people think. You would be surprised on some of the good ideas that you would probably come up with in how to kind of gauge a police officer's mentality throughout the years and what you can do to mitigate that and to fix it. And if you have to cut it out, you know, hey, you know what? You got to cut it out. It's for the betterment of the community and the betterment of the department to cut it out if that's what you need to do.
Gotcha. Yeah, when I like told you earlier that I have a healthy respect for policemen, I think of it like from my own perspective. You know, like a policeman is going to work and their day-to-day job, right? They're dealing with people, sometimes criminals, on almost a day-to-day basis. And basically, it's just it's a high-risk environment, right? Like, you don't know literally if you're going to come home that night and see your family because something crazy could happen and you could get killed or injured or shot or, you know, et cetera. So just for me, I have a healthy respect for that, right? Like, I have a healthy respect for, I'm just this dude that has this phone job for Kaiser Permanente. I'm never in danger. I never almost die. You know what I mean? Like, I never have to pull somebody over and not know what's going to happen. Like, it's just, my life is very cushiony compared to that. And so I think that's where my healthy respect for them comes. But I also see the sense of urgency for how horrible that was. You know, what happened to George Floyd, how horrible that was, and knowing that cop wasn't the only cop out there that is capable of doing something like that. And that's very disturbing. You know what I mean? Like, you said that it made you, like, physically ill. For me, it was, like, one of the hardest videos I've ever seen in my life. You know, I literally, it was hard to watch. You know what I mean? Like, I got done with it. I'm like, what, did that just happen? You know, it was almost like it was hard to even fathom how that could happen in broad daylight. You know what I mean? With those people around. But it did happen, man. And that's kind of where we're at. But I think there is a chance that this could be a positive thing for American culture. I do see a lot of changes. I see a lot of things happening, to be honest with you, not only in the U.S., but even in other countries where things are changing. And whether it be, you know, doing away with a certain law or taking down, you know, statues that kind of glorified people from the past that supported slavery, you know what I mean, or Confederate stuff from a long time ago. And so I think there is some progress being made, but unfortunately there's a lot more progress to be had. It's just a huge problem. And so I think the polygraph idea you have for police definitely could work. I don't know, how expensive are those? Do you know, like, if a police department had those done, like, every year or whatever, like, are those pretty expensive to order and have done, or are they pretty inexpensive?
Affordable? I mean, if you had, you know, a technician within each department that were polygraphers, you know, and they were a paid position within the department,
yeah,
to me, that I don't think that the cost would be that astronomical from a budget perspective,
yeah,
to where, you know, you would break the bank. And to me, the cost is so much worth the reward that you would get knowing, you know, as a chief of police, you know, and I'll use my position as an example. You know,
sure.
For me to put out an MA in the proper mindset to go stand a proper watch and make sure that they're going to do everything by the book and protect, you know, whatever it be, the installation, the ship or whatever, that's key. You know, there's no value on that. You know, knowing that somebody's going to do their job, do it rightly, do it professionally, and protect whatever asset that they're doing, that's huge. And I would pay so much money for that.
Yeah.
So that's where the investment is. So that's where you need to be putting your investment in. Put your investment in people. Don't put your investment in equipment. Put it in the people. And the mind, I think, is the most powerful thing that you need to crack. You figure that out, to where you can judge and make, you know, smart decisions based on the results of those moving forward. Again, I think that you would head off some of these problems that we're seeing throughout the United States.
Gotcha. So I think that one of the last things I wanted to ask you about was your opinion. I don't know if this isn't too controversial for you to answer, but I have a certain opinion about basically the fallout of George Floyd's murder. So, you know, obviously people protested against it, which they should have, especially peaceful protests. I'm behind 1,000%. I think that it should be protested. The whole situation was bullshit, and people should be held accountable, and the time for change is now. I think that's obvious. But I have different opinions about people rioting and looting. I think that pretty much everybody agrees with the consensus that looting is not okay. It's not admirable. It's not okay. It's people just basically taking an opportunity to destroy property because of, you know, a tragedy, which I don't think anybody, you know, most people don't agree with. As far as rioting, I'm not really sure how people separate those. To be honest with you, when I think of rioting, I think of, you know, something close to looting. I mean, I guess the only difference with looting would be like going in somewhere and taking stuff. With rioting is just kind of like, you know, being kind of like, how do I say this? I look at rioting like being violent because of a cause, if that makes sense. And so whether that be being aggressive towards police or marching down the street screaming stuff, or trying to get in the way of traffic, people have to stop their cars. You know, I'm not sure how to categorize those things. But what is your two cents on those different ways that people deal with this thing? The only thing I want to say before you answer that question is, my last guest is a guy that made a really key point to me, because we talked about Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, and he said, "Listen, man, you can't tell people how to protest, because the whole point of protesting is to get your message across and to kind of have somewhat of a shock value so that it gets through to people." And so I think that point was well taken. But I do have pretty strong opinions about, you know, those three things as far as peacefully protesting, rioting, and looting. And so where do you stand on those things from your perspective?
Well, I don't think there's any shock value in, you know, people burning down, you know, property. People breaking into stores, you know, what does a Louis Vuitton bag have to do with, you know, a protest? It's got nothing to do with it. Right. You know, I believe that all the looting that you saw, that we all saw, was it was planned. I think that somebody put that together and executed it. I don't think that was just a general public. I think that was a funded movement that was done. This is my personal opinion. Not to say it's on any particular group out there, but I think it was funded. And just by looking at it, it was very organized. You're not just going to get kids from the neighborhood and be able to successfully, you know, organize something like that and get away with it. I mean, it was very calculated. It was very organized. It was very structured. So I think there was a lot of calculations and thought process put into a lot of looting that we saw. And I don't think that should be an example of any kind of protest that were put forth, that what we saw in the United States. So I wouldn't compare the two, because I think those are two separate different things.
Yeah.
To have a shock value in a protest, I mean, I think we saw that. I do. I don't think you have to, you know, harm anybody, punch anybody, kick anybody, spit on anybody to get your point across. And I think, again, that kind of goes away from us as humans and being respectful to one another. When you do that, you lost the fight by kind of speaking your protest when you put your hands on somebody, when you violated somebody's space, and when you know, try to harm somebody, you know, i.e. spitting on somebody or something to that effect. I mean, we saw elderly people, you know, getting mauled and getting beat up for getting out of their car and, you know, trying to get out of a bad situation. I mean, there's no need for that. So you can protest. That's your right. I mean, us as, you know, the defenders of, you know, the country, you know, we protect that right, and I think everybody should be able to exercise that right. That's the whole reason why you have the United States military is to, you know, uphold those type of things to where people can do. Because now, and I'm going to tell you right now, you'll never see that here in Japan. You'll never see that in any other countries I've lived on. Unruly rioting that we saw, and unlawful protests that we saw in the United States, you wouldn't see that in certain countries. Mm. So, you know, we have the ability to do that in the United States, and that's what makes the United States great. But when you take it to the next level, again, and you're hurting personnel and you're hurting property, you're burning down your communities or other communities that you don't even live in, I think that detracts from the cause, and I think that causes a negative effect on what really needs to happen. And that becomes the focal point. As we saw, that really became the focal point of the tragedy that happened with in Minneapolis.
Yeah. So how, Dee, how would you separate looting and rioting in your opinion? Because I have a hard time with that myself. Like, obviously, I know what looting is, not only just like having destruction of a property, but also going in and taking things. But then I have a hard time of categorizing rioting for myself. So
rioting would be you're damaging property. You know, you're burning, you know, vehicles. You're lighting buildings on fire.
Okay.
You're causing, you know, mass destruction. That, to me, that's rioting. Looting is you're taking advantage of a situation and you're stealing. Yeah. You know, gotcha. You're breaking into storefronts and cleaning them out of their merchandise due to what's happening. Now, does rioting lead to looting? Absolutely. But yeah. They are kind of separate. But I think rioting always leads into looting because of opportunity.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for that. I've been at a hard time trying to separate those two things and how to separate them. But yeah, that makes it pretty simple. The main difference is with looting, you're taking something. Rioting is more of just destruction of property, just for what you're trying to portray as the cause. So if the cause is that George Floyd shouldn't have been murdered and racism has been going on long enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and this is your way of demonstrating that you want to damage something, then that's what people are doing. And so, yeah, I appreciate that because that's good. In my mind, I can separate those now much better. So thank you for that.
And again, man, we just got to clean, you know, help clean up our neighborhoods, you know, and focus on that community. I think that's where we missed the mark is that whole community thing. And again, that whole mentality that it takes the village. Yeah. Take race, you know, race shouldn't have a problem. It shouldn't be involved in that. You know, color shouldn't be involved in that. We're all human beings breathing air on this earth. And that everybody deserves, you know, the respect, the honor, and the integrity of being humans. I think we get to that mentality, and I think we'll be in a better place.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. So in closing, Dee, is there anything that you want to plug before I let you go, whether it be triathlon, where it's going to be, where obviously I can't go because it's in Japan, but anything you want to plug before I let you go?
I mean, the only thing I'll plug is these New York Football Giants, man.
Oh, geez.
They're going to have a sensational season. They're going to have a sensational season this year.
Are they?
And even though we gave you Odell Beckham Jr., it just goes to show you, no matter the talent that you have on a team, as long as the team is dysfunctional,
right,
they're never going to succeed, man. So the Browns will always be bad.
Always. Oh, wow. You used the A word. Always. You know, if I
That's one of the things I miss, man. We always bantered about football on the ship, and it was awesome. You always put a smile on my face, you know, whenever we get done talking. We can talk the craziest trash about football, and you know, and I give it to you. You're one knowledgeable football guy, especially when it comes down to fantasy football. It's one of the things I've always remembered.
Yeah.
And you knew individual players' stats and kind of how they operate, but
yeah.
I just think you need a better team, bro.
So I guess last question is, how do you think the Giants are going to do this season in reality, aside from you teasing me about the Browns?
I'll be honest. I'm excited. We've had some turmoil with the coaching staff. I mean, Ben McAdoo, that guy was a train wreck.
Yeah.
I think Pat Shurmur probably could have been good had he had some other tools around him, maybe some stronger assistant coaches. I think he probably would have been a little bit more successful, and maybe some better. I don't know if they're better players. I think the Giants have some decent players. But I think if he had a better cast around him from a coaching perspective, I think he would have probably been more successful. Because you look at the defense. The defense was abysmal last year, which has been for a couple of years. But we got a stud, Saquon Barkley. We got some stud wide receivers that are, you know, at this point, they're no names. You know, they're not no big glams like OBJ. I'll be honest with you. I was sad when I saw that trade go through. I was like, I mean, my boys got Beckham jerseys, and you know, and I took them. You know, before I went on deployment, we went to a Giants Redskins game in Jersey, and I got them on the field, and you know, they got to see the players up front. It was great, and then shortly after that, we see OBJ rolling out in New York and going to the Browns. So that was sad. Because I think he's a talented dude and he's a great receiver. And you guys are blessed to have him. Hopefully you guys do something with him.
Yeah.
But I think the Giants are going to do well this year. I like Joe Judge. He's a good coach.
Yeah, I've heard good things about him. Yeah, man, with the Giants and the Browns, I think you're right about the dysfunctional stuff with the Browns. It's been a recurring theme. I actually am very optimistic about the Browns this year as well, because of the new coach and new GM. I just think we have a lot of good pieces, and our rosters has a lot of talent and it's very young. So it's really exciting for the future. But like you said, you gotta put it together on the field. So it doesn't matter what you have on paper, you know, chemistry and Baker Mayfield getting his head out of his ass, all that stuff matters. So, but yeah, I'm excited, man. Hopefully we have a full football season with all this COVID stuff. Everything's kind of put on hold, but
I mean, and who's a better tandem between Jarvis Landry and Odell Beckham Jr.? I mean, if you look at any of the other teams, I mean, from a football functional standpoint, I think the Browns have the best tandem, you know, wide receivers, one on one side, one on the other, that could dominate, you know, the field. It's just got to be put together. So who knows, man? Maybe this is your guy's year to win that first Super Bowl.
Get over the hump. Shoot, man. At this point, yeah. I just take going to the playoffs. You know what I mean? You gotta crawl before you walk. But
well, yeah, I'm always, if you're gonna go, you might as well go. If you're gonna go, you might as well go all the way. Or else you're gonna be hearing from me.
Yeah, that's fair, man. Well, I'll let you go. I know it's crazy to think that it's about 1 p.m. over there because it's about 10 o'clock over here p.m., but you're halfway across the world, so I guess it makes sense. But, yeah, always great to talk to you, man. I definitely will stay in touch now that I know. I didn't realize until recently that you don't have Facebook anymore. So now that I have your number and I can just text you whenever, I'll do a better job of staying in touch that way. And then, like I said, once you are able to move back to the States, God willing, if you're ever in Colorado, you know, we'll definitely link up. You and your family can crash my place, and it'll be great.
Hey, man, brother, I appreciate it, man. It's been an honor and a privilege to get this time to chat with you and just catch up, man. It's been awesome.
Yeah, likewise. Well, I appreciate your time, D. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
All right, brother. Take care, man. Be safe.
I'll see you. You too. Bye.
And there you have it. Mr. Darren Villano, awesome interview, awesome guy. Missed the heck out of him. So hopefully you guys enjoyed as much as I did. So with that being said, that's all I have for you this week. Next week I have a referral from my aunt, actually, that I'm going to pursue for my next interview. It sounds like it's going to be another awesome interview, so stay tuned for that. But yeah, great to talk to you guys. Hope you guys had a good week. and hope you have a good weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.